Live from Fern Gully, this is Drill Trains of Thought. Okay, hello, Timothy.
Hola.
It's humid and wet.
It is very humid, yes. Well, it's almost as wet as it was back in Indiana.
I know, and that's saying something.
But I'm
bunching. But it's kind of nice here. I mean,
it is very nice.
Beautiful, and we're kind of a little smaller than we were normally.
I'd be a little nervous about being in the rain jungle. I mean, you've been in the rain jungle before. Yeah. I've never have. Rain jungle, rainforest.
I was gonna just let it fly. See how long it went.
I would feel nervous in rainforest under normal circumstances, but being this small, I'm afraid someone's just gonna pop around the corner and eat me.
She went off to get us some food, but we had that nice fairy running around.
Yeah, I don't know. She didn't seem too familiar with humans, and at least not really good impressions of us anyway.
No, we'll try to change her mind.
What's
the worst that can happen?
I'm not going to think about that.
Okay, good. That's good.
I mean, I'm not surprised fairies fairies are kind of, you know.
Flighty.
Drunt-unch. Wow. Anyway, how have you been, Nick?
I've been pretty good. How about you?
Okay. I guess I can't complain.
Wet in Indiana, wet here.
Yeah, anyway, it's I'm all wet.
Yep.
Hey, it's better than last time, I guess.
Yes. Yeah.
At least
there's good fruit and food here, so
that's true.
Just don't drink the water. No,
I'll take your word on that.
I did get sprayed. That's awesome. Okay, I said water.
Oh yeah, I told you we're someplace else.
No, it's nice. So how about we start first with a little bit of listener feedback?
Listener feedback.
We got some comments, or a comment, or I guess multiple comments from the same person last episode. Nathan Marchand, who we name dropped in when we were talking about Tim's not taste for Pacific Rim.
Did we actually say that he might have something to say about it?
I think we probably did.
Okay. Yeah. Well, and he did, of course, because Nate is very big.
He likes giant monsters.
Yeah, monsters and robots and all that kind of stuff, but particularly monsters. He's a big Godzilla fan. We talked about that before on here. Yeah. His explanation for where that taste comes from is, for Pacific Rim, which actually, it really does have, that movie does have a lot going for it besides just monsters. And I agree with him. He pointed out that it has some very cool cinematography. The color, there's a lot more colors in that than a lot of blockbusters nowadays, honestly.
Yeah.
Which I appreciate.
Did you see the new Godzilla yet?
I have not seen the new Godzilla yet.
I don't think that's very colorful.
Okay.
I mean, just from my previews and stuff. I could be wrong.
I don't think it could be nearly as colorful as Pacific Rim because they do a lot with that in there. But he also, he really likes the design for the creatures and the robots and that they have some recognizable traits, but also seem alien, that, you know, obviously the creatures themselves.
And see, Nathan's a world builder as a... more of a world builder than I am, I think, when it comes to world, and he approaches movies somewhat in the same way.
Yeah, I could see that. And I admitted when we were talking in the comments that I admitted I've grown to appreciate creature design a bit more from my fascination with all things Jim Henson.
Yeah.
And especially, like, if you ever get a chance to watch, I think it's on iTunes. Unfortunately, it sounds like they're not going to get another season, but when they did the Jim Henson's Creature Shop Challenge on
I've
Sci-Fi.
I've seen a few of those.
That was a fascinating... It was by far my favorite reality show I've ever seen, just because it was, the format wasn't anything unusual for a reality show. You know, your typical group of contestants that are, they may have to make us do a specific challenge each week, but just the process, you get to see them go through it, the challenges they had to do were all very interesting.
Yeah.
And the imagination and the creativity and what they had to do to get to each point. It was a fascinating show, even for someone like me, that alien stuff is not what first draws me into fantasy and science fiction. And then Nate also points out that in Pacific Rim, the heroes are always kind of on the brink of defeat and survive by the skin of their teeth. So, you know, there are a lot of elements in these kind of movies that, I can identify with. the whole combination. Again, usually the big monsters in themselves aren't going to do it for me, but yeah. I can see why they do it for some people.
Though, just as a sidetrack with mentioning Pacific Rim, you just told me that recently we just passed the day that was the first episode of Evangelion, if it was real life.
Oh, yes. Yeah, the first episode took place like earlier this week.
Yeah.
Which is... Thank goodness that didn't happen.
We don't have Bloody Oceans or the first Impact. Or Second Impact? Which one was it? I think it might have been Second because... Anyways, it was the first or second Angel landed in Antarctica. And
yeah.
So, if you don't know what we're talking about, thank goodness it didn't happen in real life.
Okay. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
All right.
Do you remember when First Impact... We'll get away from Evangelion in a second here. But when did First Impact happen? Or when was that supposed to happen in the context of the series? Was it like 10 years before the series begins?
It was around like 99, like one of those like 2099, wasn't it?
Okay, it could be. Well, because what's her name was a kid at the time.
You know what? Actually, I might completely be misremembering, but I wonder if the kids that could run the things weren't like born right around that time.
Oh, yeah, that could be. Yeah,
my knowledge is fuzzy now, but
it's possible. Evangelion is weird. If you decide to watch it, be warned. It's weird.
Very impressionable. I mean, it's lasted a long. It was the first anime really ever watched, and it stuck with me a long time. I mean, I don't think I've rewatched it for 15
good reason.
Years. Everyone's been like, maybe I should, but I haven't quite worked up.
Well, I mean, you got to see the movie remakes,
which is nice. Yeah, those are pretty cool.
Yeah,
those are nice, and not quite so hopeless.
Yes.
All right, but. I guess moving on.
Yeah, so go check out that conversation in the comments at derailedtrainsofthought.blogspot.com.
Yeah, leave us comments. We like comments.
Yeah, it's good to have a conversation.
And we'll name drop you.
So. Yeah, I know I saw another listener just the other night at a concert, and she was like, yeah, you guys need to podcast more. And I would say to her, you need to comment more.
You heard that.
Let your presence be known.
Well, then we'll move on from listener feedback to Story School.
Yeah, Story School, that one thing we do every single time.
I would go to lead up to it really triumphantly, and my word stopped, so I just like, Story School.
All right, what are we talking about tonight, Dick?
Tonight, we are talking about...
today, or whenever you happen to be listening to this.
It's hard to tell. The trees are covering the...
Yeah.
Anyways. we're talking about... how we put I'm trying to think. I want to say message movies, but it's not just movies. It's when
a story comes with some sort of message,
deep message. You know, an agenda sometimes.
Yeah, agenda.
And
yeah,
there's a whole range of it, but sometimes it comes with a deep agenda, and sometimes not as much.
Right. Well, I mean, all artists are trying to say something with their story.
I guess that was the first thing I wanted to mention is that all art has a message, or it wouldn't really be called art.
Yeah.
But there does seem to be this line that people cross that suddenly people say, oh, now it's heavy-handed, or now it's a message movie, or now it's something beyond just art.
Mm, it's trying to preach something.
You're trying to, preachiness. And I'm not completely sure that sort of message art is always bad, because I was thinking about this, you know, that line, obviously, you cross and people complain, but before that line, I would get most of the great works of art are saying something pretty directly. I mean...
If you're talking about, like, say, Dante.
I mean, you're talking about, like, a lot of what people call literature.
Mm-hmm.
You know, talking, you know, Les Mis. I mean, it's very over
true.
The top.
Yeah.
Or very... you know, anything Dickens. Or, I mean, even you get to more modern stuff, and it's like, you know, The Stranger by Camus, or, you know. So having a message does not mean it's not artful.
Yes.
Even if the message is the purpose for the book.
Hmm. Interesting.
So we've got to figure out where that line is that turns it from not being artful. Is it just bad artistry, or is there something else?
Well, let's recap a little bit on what we've said before about Christian fiction.
Okay.
That's labeled as such.
Yeah.
Because if you've been listening to the podcast, if you've listened to a lot, we've dealt with this a couple times. Yeah. But in case you haven't, and this is a good recap just for all of us, you know, Nick and I, our personal opinion is we don't necessarily... We don't try to preach through our stories, you know, as much as possible, but we do write and we do create out of our belief system.
Yeah, that the world we believe works a certain way, and our fiction world will reflect
will reflect that.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, it'll just naturally come out in through the storytelling. Yeah. But we've also talked about, and I've addressed that, I do think that there is a place for some Christian fiction that is overt. The Christianity is kind of a big deal, especially when it comes to kid stuff.
Yes.
Because you want to, you know, for kids, you kind of have to spell out the message, the lesson. Otherwise, they just won't get it. The question is, at what point, I think, when you're writing for adults or for teens, you know, when does it when does it burden down the story?
Much? When does it become bad art?
Yeah,
largely. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, sometimes you can be very extravagant. I mean, I was just now I was thinking being overt. I mean, C.S. Lewis in many of his stuff is very overt. I mean, Great Divorce.
I mean,
you don't get much more, you know, on the nose than some of that stuff. And that's considered great art. Well, I mean, most people would read, even they disagreed with it, would not say it was not well done.
Yeah. Well, Great Divorce is an unusual book because it's not quite really fiction.
That's true. It is more almost allegory.
Yeah. It's not, I mean, and it's not quite, it's not like Pilgrim's Progress where everything represents something.
Yeah. That's true. It is not quite in that same category.
Yeah.
And I wonder, you know, well, I guess, okay, here's one line. I don't think this is the main line we're going to be talking about. But I think sometimes people call foul on too preachy or you've burdened down the story if they don't agree with what's being preached.
Oh, that's a possibility.
I think the line moves depending whether you agree with it or disagree with it.
I can see that because there are a lot of Christians that will not view Christian movies or Christian media stories as being preachy because they agree with all of it.
They think lightly, that's how it works.
Yeah, or pretty much.
That's how people should, you know, or should work. You know?
And then like some of the artists who are actually Christian be like, no, that came off really kind of forced or, you know.
And I think it worked with all kinds of different worldviews. I know, I know people are highly politicized.
Yeah.
And if they watch a movie that they can tell the other views there, it just turns them off, even though it might not matter to the movie that much.
There's a handful of movies like that in the Oscars that get nominated for Oscars every year that anyone outside of Hollywood can see, wow, you guys really are pushing your own agenda in this movie. And then all the insiders inside Hollywood are like, yeah, this is great artistry.
Well, it's like I've read The Fountainhead, but I've never read Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand.
Okay.
And Ayn Rand, if you don't know, is very, you know, conservative.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought her up because I've never read her myself, but that is one that gets brought up a lot in this sort of.
Because conservatives love her. Conservatives think, like, her books are genius.
Uh-huh. And but you has Zach read any of her
stuff? He's read both of them.
Okay. Does he like him?
Okay. Yeah. Now, the thing is, I've heard people complain about Ayn Rand that she's very didactic and very. Like, I guess in Atlas Shrugged, the last 70 pages is basically a speech that this guy's giving.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Uh-huh.
But I think the problem is a lot of people go into reading Ayn Rand to see basically the battle of ideas. That's the point of reading. I mean, it's not quite the level of Great Divorce, you know, but it's more like, let's see how these ideas are personified in this sort of world, as opposed to, I want a realistic version of the world. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I don't know. Again, Fountainhead, I love Fountainhead a lot because it felt very true to me. And I think when something rings true, you don't call foul.
Okay. Well, here's a thought or maybe a question. What about, like, say, Orwell, 1984, or Brave New World? Yeah. You know, those the two famous dystopia books.
Yeah.
Those are obviously, you know, they're kind of, I mean, they're fiction.
Yeah.
They obviously have a very specific point that they're trying to get across. But I don't know that anyone would accuse them of... They're almost party neutral, what they're trying to say with it. And maybe that's the difference. Because I think if your movie is trying to say something that's sort of considered a universal truth, like, you know, Brotherhood of Man, no one's going to, you know, downplay that. Yeah. But when you're trying to make your story about an issue that people disagree on, maybe that's kind of the, like, I don't know about this.
That might be, and I wonder, too, whether it's partly one stage of it is, if you're writing an idea novel, writing a message movie, that it's not presented as anything else. from straight up, you're like, this book is going to be about this subject.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to saying, we're going to do a nice, happy, you know, cartoon, and then we're going to hit you with a head that, you know, it's called Happy Feet, and it's about penguins, but it's really about global warming.
Yes.
You know, yes. I think the bait and switch is part of the thing that makes people call foul.
Yes.
As opposed to you call it, you know, burning feet, and then you go.
Yes. I totally agree. Like, that brings to mind a movie I saw once called The Ghost Rider, which is directed by Roman Polanski. He's,
okay.
He's very popular, you know, director in Hollywood, and it's got Ewan McGregor in it.
Okay.
I think my mom had got it through Netflix one time, and I've ranted about it somewhere, but I don't remember if it was on this podcast or not, so I'll bring it up. But it was actually a really interesting political thriller.
Yeah.
And Ewan McGregor is like this reporter, and he's like, I think Pierce Brosnan is a former president and all this stuff, and he's doing some investigation. Anyway, and it's the first two-thirds of it is really interesting, suspenseful, good filmmaking stuff.
Yeah.
Then, at some point, you realize that this whole conspiracy is basically a thinly disguised attack on the Bush administration. Okay. And the whole, he started Iraq for, like, political yeah. reasons and all, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very, like, when the veneer is stripped away and you realize that's what it is, like, I lost all interest yeah. in the movie, and I actually got really mad because I felt like I had been suckered into the thing.
Yeah.
You know, you're just watching this fun story, and all of a sudden it becomes a political tirade.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's no fun.
And I think maybe the other thing with 1984 and Brave New World is that even though they were probably written in response to something very current, their message continues to be universal. Like, it doesn't feel like it's attacking one particular thing. Like, it's just attacking the Bush administration or the Obama administration.
Yeah.
It's attacking a mindset.
Mm.
You know, it's attacking a...
a bad habit, almost.
Yeah, yeah. yeah. Like, and I think good art can make you feel like this is a universal truth, not just my personal truth.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's part of it, too. You know, you might not agree, read 1984, the world's actually like that, but you would agree that a world that did that is not right.
Yeah.
You know, because some people say, oh, this is where we're going. Other people are like, no, we're not. You know, they have political arguments and stuff.
Uh-huh.
But that doesn't take away from the fact that the book is saying true things about conformity or nonconformity.
Sure. And I think there may be cases, too, where a viewer or a reader may still not like the book because they would still, that whatever the artist is trying to communicate through that story doesn't resonate with them. That's mm-hmm. still possible. But if it's done artistically well, they won't necessarily think of it as a preachy sort of thing. They may not even realize that's what they didn't like about the movie, you know?
Yeah. And I wonder, I mean, do you think with good enough art, you could make anything you want to say good? I mean, like, even, like, current political satire or whatever? Or is there some sort of distance you need for it to not feel messagey?
I don't know. I mean, that's, you know, and some of this is kind of subjective.
Yeah, yeah, certainly.
I mean, I know for a long time, I don't know if film schools still do this. I didn't see it when I was in film school, but for a long time, a lot of film students, they still studied Birth of a Nation, even though it's considered a terribly racist piece of filmmaking. It still got studied for a long, long time because it was so effective at what it was trying to do. And, you know, people hate the movie, but they also realize, you know, kind of respect. I don't know if respect is the right word.
Yeah.
But they realize this was made very sincerely in a sense. He's doing a lot of innovative things with his filmmaking. I mean, this is a silent film.
Yeah.
It's basically sort of a silent documentary, but it's largely propaganda.
Yeah.
And am I thinking of the right one? Birth of a Nation, is that the Hitler one?
Or I don't remember.
That might be the Hitler one. There's another one that's more about that's about the South. And it's about, like, racism in America, but it's very, you know, KKK. I can't think of what the name of. Now I'm going to have to look it up.
But, well, meanwhile, I'll talk.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think, actually, related to the art thing, I remember my notes I wrote. And sometimes I think it's, if the truth has to be presented with complexity, I think that's a knock people sometimes have with Christian movies, is that it's too simple.
Oh, yeah.
You know, everything's stark, black and white.
Yeah, it's all boiled down to this.
And I think, you know, even if it wasn't, and again, that's part of art, but that's not necessarily, not even the technique, sometimes just the having it feel like real life, or at least a version of real life that you know, not necessarily has to be realism, but that at least people act like people act that you've seen, that you know. I mean, that's like in Ayn Rand, there's characters, they're just despicable, or this person that is a, and they're obviously in ways symbols for certain types of things, but you're like, I know people who are kind of like that.
Yeah.
You know, you can point and say, you know, and if you watch the movie, you're like, I don't know anyone who would act like that.
Mm.
Then something goes, you know, and I think sometimes you have villains, you're like,
No one's that ridiculous over, you know.
No one's that evil, or no one's that careless. You know?
Like an Avatar, the military figure is that, we're just going to kill them all. And you're like, yeah, you're a cardboard.
Yeah, exactly. Stereotype. I mean, if you would have added just a smidge of, like, reason they would do it, it wouldn't have taken much, and you could have done the same meaning and had a lot more people buy into it.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a certain amount of complexity, a certain amount of reflection of, oh, yeah. I mean, because you got to make it, if you're trying to convince someone of an idea, you got to make them feel like it fits in the real world.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's what falls apart a lot of times. And the problem with the Christian art sometimes is that there are things that happen very drastically to people.
Yeah.
But if you don't know a person like that, you're like that.
And that is the limitation of fiction and telling Christian truth in a lot of sense. I mean,
because it's a very, because, you know, to strip away the fiction, in real life, it's a very personal and it can be a very unique thing that doesn't translate well to sometimes to the sort of universal palette you use in fiction.
Mm-hmm. And like, you know, there's that saying, truth is stranger than fiction.
Yeah.
Christian testimonies, you know, the word of our testimony is strange. You know, some of the stories that
if you wrote it in a book, you'd be like, no way. And then you hear a person say, you're like, wow.
Yeah. Well, this guy was like persecuting Christians and then he just happened to see Jesus. Come on.
Yeah, exactly. That's the deus ex machina. Yes.
Exactly.
I mean, that's the problem. I mean, when you have not God out of the machine, but God out of the heaven come and mess up your drama, you know.
Right.
Art people say foul and we say life.
Basically. You know, yeah, you really can't do that in a fictional context as well.
Not without setup, not without other things.
Now, and that's an interesting, well, this may be a tangent, but this is Darrell Trains of Thought.
Go for it.
But I mean, when we did one of our co-author projects, we had that one discussion about the one story that you finished.
Oh, yes.
Where in that one, basically, God does kind of take a role in the effects, but that one we sort of felt like the villain had been challenging God so directly the entire time.
Well, and there was a spiritual beginning, too, to the whole story.
That's true,
story.
Yeah. I mean, it was a superhero thing where the superhero basically got her powers from animal spirits,
but I'm not sure they were, I don't think they claimed like in the Native American, I can't remember, but it seemed to have been within a theistic context.
Yeah, within a theistic context. Very much like Tolkien using like the idea of guardian angels basically kind of governing the earth sort of thing.
Yeah, and it just seemed like it was a necessary and right step as opposed to like out of the blue. You're like, suddenly, haha, insert God.
Yeah. You know?
I mean, and it works for you. I think we probably joked on here before, and you know, Indiana Jones, it's Deus's arc. I mean, but they've set that up.
They set it up from that the arc was really powerful, and you know, you better take it seriously. And even before the end, like, you know, when they're digging up the cave, and suddenly there's a big thunderstorm outside, and like, man, should they really be doing this?
So anyway, that's slightly sidetracked, but I think that's a good sidetrack.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about something that maybe doesn't. Actually, just to go back real quick, Birth of a Nation is the one I was thinking about.
Okay.
And that's the southern one. I don't remember. There's also a Nazi propaganda film that I think was almost, but I can't think of the name of it. You could look it up. But to kind of look at a recent movie that sort of cuts against this, you know, this theory we have that it's, you know, if you're going for a universal thing, then it's less likely to be accused as preachy. Tomorrowland recently came out.
Yes, I had that on my list.
Which got a lot of criticism from. I mean, it was interesting. The critics were pretty split.
Yeah, on this, like, one. This is great, or
this is way too. The message you're trying to do is bogging down. There's this big. Yeah. There's a speech that when a bad guy gives toward the end that just kind of feels kind of weighty but in that one, it's very kind of like human optimism. Like, we can make this world a better place. You know, which is something we should all be able to agree with.
Yeah.
Now, there are worldviews in the movie I probably wouldn't agree with, but that's not really the main thrust of it, I don't think.
And I wonder, the thing with Tomorrowland, I think there's probably two angles you can go on that one. Partly, I think, it's that do you agree with it or not? And I think there's sort of people who just, they're just more pessimistic and it just doesn't feel right to be that cheery.
I don't know if that there's something, I thought it was interesting that they talk about how they try to warn people about the Earth being in danger, and then we kind of turned the apocalypse into this entertainment genre. Yeah. And
which to me rang really true.
Yeah, it did ring really true. But I mean, I'm sure there are some people who are like, but I like that stuff. Don't be picking on my post-apocalyptic.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
And you know, we write a post-apocalyptic series ourselves.
Well, I read an interview with Damon Lindelof. He's like, his other show, with Leftovers, is basically a post-apocalyptic world.
Right.
I mean,
it's not like it's trying to be anti, but it's an interesting trend to explore.
Well, not only that, but the trend's more of a symptom than the cause.
Yes.
And I think, like, I liked it, my brother liked it, and I think partly because when the bad guy was doing that speech, we're like, that's how people work.
Yeah.
You know, that we do tend to feed on bad things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just kind of say, give up. And to us, that rang true enough that we didn't feel like it was preachy. We felt like it was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Other people might have just thought it was too much, or like maybe they felt accused. Maybe they felt like, you know, you're overstating it. And I mean, and the movie, granted, was very
humanistic in a lot of ways.
It was humanistic, and it was very black and white. It was, you know, I suppose we mentioned complexity. It was probably more just, you know, no shade. There were not many shades of gray in it.
That's true.
Which always nowadays makes people touchy. Yeah.
Well, I think one thing that did wind up hurting the movie in some ways is that this was more of a children's movie than I think it was marketed.
Oh, that might, yeah.
Because, like, I mean, really, you know, in that sense, it being simplistic is not a bad thing because kids movie. Not to say that kids movies should be dumb, but I mean, and I don't think it was a dumb movie.
They don't need to be gray.
Yeah, they don't need as many different shades of gray in it as, you know, an adult movie often tries to get.
And the thing is, I'm not sure for the sake of the movie itself, for the theme of the movie, gray wouldn't work. I mean, that's what impressed me about the movie. I'm kind of in Taking Tails mode now, but is it was filmed with this exuberance.
Yeah.
I mean, the action scenes and the dialogue.
It was fun.
It was just fun. It was like an old 80s movie.
It was an old adventure kids movie of like, you know, where, the adults have failed us, and so the kids kind of have to go off on their own.
In that genre, you need the monologuing bad guy.
Yeah.
In some ways.
No, I felt it worked in the context of the thing, but it's interesting that have kind of come to such a point where, yeah, if this was a movie for adults, you try to say your point too overtly, then you get accused of being preachy.
Yeah, which the thing is a relatively new thing, I think, because I think movies have been pretty on the nose for in the past.
Yeah.
And there's plenty of new movies that are. I mean, any Pixar movie is pretty upfront about what it's actually trying to say. And no one claims, "Up is preachy," you know. They're like, "Up is great because it's true."
Yeah, I can. Yeah, so it's an interesting world in terms of a little hypersensitivity on the.
And I mean, everyone's super hypersensitive with anything that might offend them, or seem slightly different than what they've been.
Than
what they're used to, and I get that. I mean, I get that. You know, I get that every once in a while, like, some movie that pushes an agenda that or has just a point of view that's I think is.
Yeah.
Wrong. I get a little antsy, you know. But.
Well, and like Brad Bird pointed out on Twitter, you know, optimism is pretty, you know, subversive right now.
Yeah.
I mean, let's be honest. You know, this is a very cynical society we live in. So that's one reason why this movie just felt so different.
I remember when WALL-E came out, you know, some of the more conservative people didn't much like it because it had the whole, like, we destroy the world and, you know, natural, you know, because they're always kind of touchy about any movie that has a lot of ecological disaster. But that movie didn't feel, it felt to me more like a true warning of, look, if we're going to live big and large, this is kind of the consequence.
Uh-huh.
As opposed to saying.
Yeah, for me, it was more of it didn't bother me because that was like the setting. It didn't feel preaching to me, and it's like, this is a big what if. What if the Earth was covered in trash and there's just one robot left?
I think because it's such a, you know, it's such a topical thing, global warming and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And that there's a certain section of the population that's hypersensitive to those things.
It could be, but I think they need to get over it at this point. And this is why I say that. I kind of feel like pop culture has sort of learned its lesson about being Well, I don't know. You still had Happy Feet, which is apparently like oververt, and it's
yeah.
But I mean, you.
It's got to matter, certainly.
I mean, they're, you know, we're Ferngully.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of the poster child for a movie where everyone knows it's being like,
yeah,
it's sappily, you know, sickeningly preachy.
Why
and everyone knows
complain
it?
About the new the reboot Muppet movie.
Okay.
You know, they complain about Tex Richman and like, seriously, guys. It's
yeah.
like, this is the Muppets always have ridiculous villains.
You know, they're. Oversensitivity is something that affects both sides
oh,
of the political
certainly.
Spectrum.
Oh, certainly. No, I completely
conservatives
agree
and liberals.
Yeah.
I mean,
it just depends what the issue you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. it's really quite ridiculous.
And so some of it, I don't know the artist's fault. Sometimes I think you can do a perfectly fine in your context thing, and it still comes off as preachy.
Yeah, that's entirely possible.
Because you just talk about issues.
Yeah.
Because art talks about issues.
Uh-huh. I don't know if there's a good solution to it because you're kind of like in trouble if you do, in trouble if you don't, almost.
Yeah. If people, you know, if you make it with no message at all, people are like, this is mind numbing. You should say something important with your life.
Yeah.
but I do think things to help make it better, like we've said, is a certain amount of complexity. You know, at least that people act like real people act or it rings true.
Yes, right.
You know, even Tomorrowland, if it's a little more white and dark as opposed to gray, for the people that work for it, rang true.
Mm-hmm. And we've always said, know your story, what kind of story you're trying to tell.
If you're doing an idea movie or message book, do it. And don't pretend to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, like, half do it.
Well, and...
Like, State of Fear, I think I mentioned here by Michael Crichton.
Yeah, I was going to say Michael Crichton.
It's not really a book. I mean, the story is basically a way to loosely connect research he's done on global warming. I mean,
right.
And put things into, I'm sure some people thought it was horrible because there's eco-terrorist stuff, but it's sort of a what if with lots of science.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like a mockumentary, you know, I mean, that's not quite right, but it's like a half documentary and half like, let's give a cool plot line so that it doesn't sound like a documentary.
Uh-huh.
Or like Next, which was, I think, the last thing I read of his, which was more like lots of half stories of how genetics go horribly wrong than the actual. There's like almost all these random genetical things that could happen in real life, kind of vaguely tied together in a loose plot line. But it was really, you don't go reading it because you want
the suspense.
Like a Tom Clancy book.
Okay.
Uh-huh. You go reading it because it's scary to learn what scientists might do in 10 years with. In science fiction, some of it's really been a lot of science fiction is idea based. Is
mm-hmm.
okay, I'm going to take what's going on right now, I'm going to jump it 10 years in the future. And then I'm going to write it. And hard science fiction tends to be a little light on character.
Uh-huh.
And
that's
really
true.
Heavy on facts and what ifs and people playing parts in order to explain things.
Mm-hmm. It's about all about extrapolating that idea and
putting, kind of showing it. And you read hard science fiction differently than you read adventure, or you should.
Yeah, and you should read, you know, a kid's movie differently than you would read a
Oscar movie.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
I mean, there's still, you know, still sometimes like, yeah, that doesn't flow naturally or whatever, but
mm-hmm.
yeah.
So, yeah.
And no one to say State of Fear is but great art by any means. I mean.
But it's not bad for what it is.
It's not bad for what it is. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And I think it's really hard to do the great art heavy message thing, you know, but like Camus tries, you know, some of the existentialists try, like Waiting for Godot.
Okay.
You know, it's basically like an example of what living an absurd life is,
mm-hmm.
but it's funny.
So again, we don't have any hard, fast rules as usual.
No, we never have answers here. If only art had an answer.
It was quantifiable enough.
I know. Then this would be a math podcast.
Stuart Lim would be a much happier man.
Art is much closer to quantum mechanics than Newtonian physics.
I will take your word on that, Mr. I ace my SAT.
Not quite. So, we'll do our first soundtrack. So after all that trying to figure out about messages, I had to find a soundtrack that had meant. No, this is a radio broadcast from the 1950s. No.
This is, again, where our lack of current game knowledge is sort of...
Yeah, but I'm sure there's games that hit you over the head too heavily.
But the
problem is I haven't played a new game since. Who knows?
Well,
new games are 10 years old, you know.
I mean, you've played, like, Wii stuff. But yeah. you've not dived into
I played
like
Fez. That's the one I knew.
That's true. You've played games off of Steam.
But yeah, those are not particularly. They're more puzzly games.
Yeah, you haven't gotten to like dive deep into a story
like
game
BioShock or something like that. I think actually one of those has
probably
things about religion and stuff. But anyway, so what I went with is there is this system you may have heard of, probably not, called the Sega Pico.
Nope.
Which was basically. From what I understand, kind of like a leapfrog, kind of a kid laptop to do teaching games sort of stuff.
Educational type.
Yep. And so there's one remix on Overclock Remix from the system.
For all the parents who thought video games would just rot their kids' brains so they gave them something educational instead.
So this is from a game called Tales and the Picture Maker?
Music Maker. I've got it up here on my screen.
It's remixed by Zircon. It's called Picolescence. And it's kind of groovy. So... enjoy. Be educated, or else. Welcome back. That was your foray into the Sega Pico.
Very chill.
Yes. Enjoyable.
Yes.
All right. Now we'll go to a system. No. The system is down.
The system is down.
We'll now go to a part of the podcast we like to call Our Take
on Tales.
All right. So this is, if you have not listened to the podcast before, shame on you. But
welcome.
Welcome. I mean, hi. I'm so glad you could be here. But we hope this is the part where we kind of talk about different books, movies that we've done and that or that we've read, that we've ingested.
Ingested. Digested.
Osmosed. And, you know, kind of analyze them, suggest them to you. Stuff that has not been on Weekly Hijack.
Yes.
Our sister podcast where we talk about Lost and other TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
So should I start this one, Tim?
Yes, go for it.
All right, so I recently read my first William Faulkner novel.
Ooh.
The Sound and the Fury.
Was it so, furious?
It was something. Was it, was it soundful?
It sounds like, it seems like there's a Fast and the Furious sequel title in there somewhere.
The Sound and the Fury.
Anyway, continue.
This would be the opposite of the Fast and the Furious, I'm pretty sure. Okay, this book is fascinating. Like,
fascinating? I'm done.
Wow. Just kicked into the next gear. We better put a break to that.
Stop. Get on with your review.
Get on with it. Okay. So this review is going to be a lot less exciting than that was. Okay. So The Sound and the Fury is a strange book. It's an odd book. Here's the idea. Well, let me explain it as I read it. There's four sections to this book, each in a different point of view.
Okay.
The first point of view...
Sounds very modern.
It is very modern. It's like super postmodern. It's very stream of consciousness. The first 70 pages I'm starting to read is very complicated because it's written from the point of view, and you don't find this out right away because it's from the point of view of this guy, of a 30-year-old, basically idiot. Like he has like the mental capacity of like a 5-year-old.
Okay.
But it's written from his point of view. So, like, he doesn't really explain things very well. There's, like, very little detail described. It's just, like, this happened. And even harder is that his mind, when he sees, like, some image, he'll immediately drop into a memory of a different from some other time. So you're jumping through time back and forth in this point of view of this 30-year-old mentally handicapped person.
Oh, wow.
For the first 70 pages. So it is really rough going, okay?
Imagine.
I mean, once you get the amazing thing is, if you stick with it and you read long sections, you get the flow that there's a lot of things that help. There's basically about two or three plot lines going, really. Okay. It's very Lost in that way.
Uh-huh.
And you start piecing together who's related to who and the, but it's very hard because there's no context at the beginning. Like if this section comes second or third, you know who all the characters are and their relationships. You know nothing. You're just there, and it's fascinating because at least for me, if you could have long sections of time, like I liked reading it, but it was like a mystery. It's like, and they do this. It turns italics briefly whenever it switches from one time period to another time period and then comes back.
Uh-huh.
I mean, not the whole section's in, just the transition is in italics between.
Okay.
But it doesn't say like 30 years before. It just all kind of flows.
Man, that would take a lot of some planning and coordination to not completely lose your readers between sections. I'm really curious how you even piece all this together.
You just start picking up on little things. At some point, I went on Wikipedia and tried to get a little context of who these people were because it's one of those books that I think would, once you have a sense, it's almost like once you've read it once, you can read it again with a lot more understanding. So I went and said, okay, help me understand who these people are. What helps between the, there's about three different time periods, that there's a different person in charge of them each time. So there's kind of these little symbols that help you figure out where you are.
Okay.
And a lot of it revolves around his name's Benji. It revolves around his relationship with Caddy, his sister. Okay. So there's lots of images of her. And you can kind of tell when they're older and younger and stuff like that. So that's the whole first section. And the whole second section is with Quentin, which is another one of his brothers. But it's like 20 years. It's not 20 years, but it's substantially earlier. And that's written, Wikipedia and other places call him that he's kind of neurotic. But basically, his sister, Caddy, basically... She messed around. She got pregnant. She was married. She got married. She decided to get married before anyone found out she was pregnant with a different guy. And then that guy broke it all. Anyways, and Quentin's one of these, I guess, Southern people just has this real strict moral thing. And one protect her sister, his sister, and like one protect all women. And that she was defiled, really, even though it was Caddy was not assaulted. She was running around. But basically, the whole day is him basically setting up to kill himself.
Oh, wow.
But his mind just kind of, he was just flopping to memories too. But he talks in this very educated, over-intellectualized way. And sometimes they mention one point almost like he starts, like his memories start breaking down in some ways. And they just kind of, there's like almost no punctuation. I mean, like the punctuation is gone in some places. And it just, like the memories just start flowing together. Like it's so weighing on him so much, it's just kind of flowing into his head. So there's like, there's no set periods. It's just like, him remembering scenes from his life. And that's rough too. Okay. Those are first, those are the hardest two sections. Third section then goes to a day after the Benji section with the third brother, Jason, who's just a horrible man.
Okay, I have to interrupt you real quick. Now, is there like an overarching story with all these sections, or is it more like a series of connected stories?
Well, see, that was my biggest problem with it, besides it's just hard, is that I guess the idea was kind of the... Because I finished it, and I was just like, the individual sections were really fascinating, but I didn't know what the purpose of the book was. As far as I can tell, it's basically just like this Compton family, that's the name of the family, was like a big Southern family. It's just kind of like their disintegration. It's like the Old South dying.
Okay.
You know, Faulkner, the Southern writer, I think it's that sort of like the Old South degenerating into this chaos. Because the last section then is not first person. The only one not first person is third person, but it largely follows around Dilsey, I believe that's her name, who's the head black servant. It's past slave times, but she still serves.
Sure.
And she's kind of like the only one who's like holds the family together. And she goes to church that day, and she helps take, and her son helps take care of Benji, her grandson. And she's just really old and beat up, but she's the only one that seems to be remotely grounded in this whole family. And it's just about, and that's about, because Benji's like Good Friday, and then Saturday is Jason's day. Quentin died a number of years before, and then her day was on Easter. And then that's the end of the book, kind of the end of that day.
What do you mean by her day? Like, is each...
Her section's a day.
Oh, are each section, is each section a day?
One day.
One day.
I mean, okay. And mass amounts of memories.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, like as a writer, reading the book was fascinating. And struggling to understand these things was really fun in some literary sort of way. I mean, like that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But at the end, it just felt like I wanted something more to make it mean something. Like the individual sections were, and I don't know whether it was just so much living these people's shoes and that, you know, it was maybe more of an experiment for them. And again, inside a class, who knows Faulkner well? I never read much Faulkner, and what kind of concerns he writes about and stuff. Maybe you could get some more. Best thing to get out from my brief looking around Wikipedia and stuff is sort of it's about the disintegration of this family and the old Southern traditions and that sort of post Reconstruction world. You know, kind of like how, you know, some British things are about the falling apart of, you know, the old empire. You know, almost like Downton Abbey is basically about, know, I think it was kind of like that.
The changing times.
They're all crazy. Except the problem is, Caddy is like the main character everyone revolves around, but she's not actually in any section. I mean, she's not her point of view, because she's the one who sleeps and she runs away, and then her daughter ends up coming back to live, and Jason's section, the third section, is his, like, stealing all the money that's supposed to go to Caddy's daughter and all this stuff. He's just very cynical, very money, materialistic. And the writing style is so vastly different than even the other two. And you just really get into what this guy, he's just not a nice guy.
Well, it sounds like Faulkner was at least very good at getting inside people's heads.
Very good. So, okay, so I have this quiz for you, Tim.
Okay.
I was explaining to my sister how this reads. And I found this little thing here. So it's called Machine Translation or Faulkner. Okay, so can you tell the prose that won a Nobel Prize from the text that needs editing? So each quote below has either been German machine translated from German, or is a sample of William Faulkner's prose. Okay. So we'll do just a couple of these, but most of the ones that are from Faulkner are largely from either the Benji or the Quentin section.
Are these all from the same book, or are they from different?
Most of the ones I recognize were from that book.
Okay,
we'll just do a couple of these. So people kind of get the sense of. The language sometimes is almost impossible.
Okay, so here's the first one. He would be sort of grand too, pulling in lonely state across the noon, rowing himself right out of noon, up the long bright air like a apotheosis, mounting into a drowsing infinity.
So is that machine translated from German text, or is that Faulkner?
It sounds more like a lyric or something. It doesn't sound like... I'm trying to identify... Like, I think if this is an actual sentence, I think the trying to diagram this sentence would be a nightmare.
Yeah. So just pick one. We'll see how if you're right or not.
I'll go with machine translation.
Okay. Number two.
If people could only change one another forever that way, merge like a flame swirling up for an instant, then blow cleanly out along the cool eternal dark. Okay, now this the previous sentence had a lot of commas.
Yeah.
You people listening wouldn't know that. This sentence feels like it needs some commas.
Okay.
But I'm going to go with that's a Faulkner one.
Okay. We don't have to do all 10 if we want, but let's do a few more just so we can.
Okay. Before my soul, like a curtain, pulled itself away, and the scene of the infinite life transforms before me into the abyss of the eternally open grave. That sounds like a Faulkner thing. That's like that. That sounds close enough to make actual sense. Yeah. I believe in that one. Okay, number four. I will am my father's progenitive.
Yeah.
I invented him, created him. Wait, I'm gonna start the sentence again.
There's no periods in this.
Okay. I will am my father's progenitive. I invented him, created I him. Say it to him, it will not be, for he will say I was not, and then you and I sense philoprogenitive. Wow. I have no idea, but I feel like a machine would actually be more grammatically correct than that mess was, so okay. I'm going to go with Faulkner.
Okay, let's do one more, number five.
Okay. It was a shadow that lay in every beautiful weather once under a tree and fluctuated like the branches in the wind. I'm really not sure. I have no idea how I'm doing in this so far.
I'm not sure either, actually. It's been long enough.
I feel like this one could go either way, but because I've said Faulkner for the last several, I'm going to go with machine on that one.
All right.
So we'll see.
I think got like 80% of the time. Okay.
Okay. I missed the first one.
Which was from The Sound of the Fury.
And I'll read that sentence again. This is not, so you know, this is, this is the machine, Trent. No, I said this was machine. It's actually an actual Faulkner quote. So we'll see if I can make sense of this. He would be sort of grand too, pulling in lonely state across the noon, rowing himself right out of noon, up the long bright air like an apotheosis, mounting into a drowsing infinity.
I believe that's describing a rower at that point.
Someone rowing a boat.
Yeah. Okay, this is mostly from the Quentin section. Quentin his mind starts working in these words that are almost not sentences to kind of, I guess, to show his neurosis.
Okay, interesting. Okay, well, the second one I got right, that is Faulkner. If people could only change one another forever that way, merge like a flame swirling up for an instant, then blow cleanly out along the cool eternal dark.
Yep, good job. Good job with
Faulkner.
I don't know.
I don't remember what my reasoning there was, but the next one
was actually machine translated.
I got wrong, so I'm not going to. Well, people might wonder what it was again. But that one was the before my soul, like a curtain, pulled itself away, and the scene of infinite life transforms before me into the abyss of the eternally open grave. That is translated from
some German text from Goethe.
Yeah, okay. Number four, I got that right. That was Faulkner.
Yep, the progenitive one.
The progenitive one. I'm not going to say that one again.
Yeah, I remember that scene. That scene was very complicated.
I imagine. the one that I really wasn't sure about was, I said machine translation, and it was.
Nice.
And that's the, it was
so,
a shadow that
so anyways, those are the worst kind of sections of it. But sometimes you just like, you can tell, especially in the Quentin part, that sometimes it's almost not so much the meaning as the sound of the meaning or at least I couldn't make heads or tails sometimes of what it would mean exactly, but almost the shadow of the meaning.
Okay.
So anyway,
it sounds like a very challenging read.
So very interesting book. I'm glad to have read it. I'm not sure I would recommend it to many people unless you're very literary. It really was more of a delving in, seeing what a person can do, delving that deep into people's point of view and stuff.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's certainly very postmodern in that sense.
Right. Would you read more Faulkner?
Apparently this Compton family, he even has there's somewhere else like a fifth part that kind of says what happened to all of them and everything. Because he has this fake county that he writes out all the time that he peoples with all kinds of people. And some of these characters show up in other books and stuff like that.
It's like a literary prairie home companion.
Yeah, very much.
Huh.
So part of me would like to, for a while, but like I've always been curious what the Absalom book is about.
Hmm.
See, from what I understand, this one's different than even his other ones in some ways.
Oh.
I don't think they're all this
cerebral.
Yeah.
Okay.
I could be wrong on that again, but he certainly knows how to change his style. I mean, there's four very different styles in this book. And he won a Nobel Prize for this book.
Okay.
So
interesting.
Anyway, so that was my English reading for the year.
Congratulations.
But it was one of those books that, like, I'd have an hour, I'm like, I'm going to sit down and read this, because you can't read it for less than that and make any sense of it. Uh-huh. Not well.
Sure.
But
well, I'm going to go on the other end of the
that's probably a good thing.
Literary pools. Because I didn't have anything real exciting or anything I was real invested in that I've read or seen lately. So I thought I might just pick a few highlights from my occasional viewing habits on Netflix. Again, to go completely on the other end of the series scale.
We don't need to be on the Faulkner end this whole time. It's a little, some of those scenes were a little depressing after a while. I was like,
Oh, I can imagine. Well, have you ever heard of a movie called Big Trouble in Little China?
I have, I believe. Or you mentioned it, maybe, is why I heard it.
Oh, maybe that's where. This is it's sort of a cult classic from the 80s, I think. My roommate had watched it a bit while I was in school, but it was some day I was busy doing homework, and I was just kind of in and out, and it's like, man, this thing is kind of crazy.
Oh, you might mention it when we watched Kung Fury.
Oh, yeah, I probably brought it up then, yeah. Well, because it's a... I'm not even sure what to qualify. I mean, it has martial arts in it.
We're having trouble describing our choices today.
It has martial arts in it, but it also has like a lot of this fantasy type stuff. I get it's from like a time when like China was still kind of considered this, you know, exotic in a sense. And it brings in a lot of like exotic mythology, but I use the term loosely because I have no idea if any of what they talked about is actually based in any Chinese mythology. Yeah. But Kurt Russell is the white male protagonist, basically. Yeah. And he's this kind of redneck truck driver, basically, that has a friend in Chinatown in San Francisco. And he and his Chinese friend, get involved in, at first is just kind of a gang war. Well, they're trying to save his friend's girlfriend who gets kidnapped by basically this prostitution ring. On their way to try to save her, they get roped into this street fight between these two Chinese gangs, which then all of a sudden gets interrupted when these, I don't know what they are exactly, they're monks? No, they're not gods because they serve like this ancient crime lord that has immortality, but he was not allowed to inhabit a human body. I'm not sure what he was actually inhabiting, but apparently.
Interesting.
So anyway, the long and short of it, so they get dragged into the seedy Chinatown underground, which is like, you know, like lots of trips through sewers, but then there's a secret underground, sort of like Temple of Doom. If instead of going inside the castle there, and you know, you have that big evil temple, except in this case, it's full of like ornate Chinese wealth and stuff, and that's what this guy has inside, with occasional monsters and dungeons mixed in with all this stuff.
Bizarre.
It is very bizarre. But here's the thing that was most confusing about this whole deal. I wasn't sure what to make of the movie for a long time. I was like, is this like a campy thing that you would see on Mystery Science Theater? But the cinematography is actually real. Like, they put a lot of money into this thing, and it actually looks pretty cool. And that's, but at the same time, I could not tell if I was supposed to take this seriously or not. And so I did some reading, and it turns out it is supposed to be sort of a action fantasy comedy. It is partly supposed to be a comedy, but after watching some of the, you know, rough tracks and things I've seen, and because it's more dated, I wasn't even sure how I was supposed to read it. I mean, there are some moments that, you know, do play out as very comical. Like the Kurt Russell character is supposedly, you know, the main protagonist, but he's so ridiculous in his gung-ho-ness and all this sort of stuff, and he's clearly in over his head, whereas like all the actual Asian people are way better at fighting and all this, you know, they're actually doing the martial arts type stuff. And
so theme of the night is art we can't quite figure out what it's supposed to be doing.
I guess this might have been better for the taste episode, but but I think if you know that going into it, instead of being confused like I was, I think you could actually have a pretty good time with it.
Yeah.
Like I said, really, really cool, like, looks. I mean, it looks very, very 80s.
Yeah.
Despite all oriental trappings and stuff. It just some of the special effects, and like they do lots of like, you know, lightning bolts out of the fingers, and then there's some other, like one of the bad guys, for some reason, his death scene, he gets really mad at the good guys for killing his master, and he gets so mad, like his head literally like balloons and then blows up.
Bizarre.
I felt like it was like referencing some form of Chinese movies that I'm not familiar with, or like some sort of Chinese, because there are some like creature horror type elements to it, that because I just don't know the genre very well, I was just massively confused by. So that's an interesting find on Netflix, but I guess it is kind of a cult classic.
Huh. I can kind of tell why. Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought I'd pick on a couple movies that I saw and I've watched on Netflix over recent months. I finally watched the first RoboCop. Have you ever seen that?
You know what? I've never actually watched the first old RoboCop.
I don't know that it's really worth it. Well, and when I was watching this, I was like, the outfit is really cool, but I felt like there's a lot of gratuitous stuff in this movie
I have heard that.
Yeah. It is an R movie and it deserves its R rating. And I kept wondering, why is there so much blood? Why are they throwing around F-bombs when they don't need to? I mean, like, I couldn't figure out why it was like so ultra-violent. Then I realized, when I looked it up, it's by the same director that did Starship Troopers.
Oh, okay. That makes more sense.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't excuse it, but apparently it's part of that guy's style. Like, I don't understand why. I mean, I remember when it was came out. I mean, I think they made action figures for it, and I think it was one of these movies that came out around that time. It's kind of like Terminator, where people were like, these are really violent movies. You shouldn't be making toys for them.
Yeah.
But I mean, the RoboCop outfit is pretty cool.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's why I kept thinking, it's like, there's a good PG-13 that doesn't need some of this other stuff.
Yeah.
And I think it had some of the same sort of like playing with media expectations. Like, you remember in Starship Troopers, there's some like, I guess propaganda, but like it plays with like the media perceptions of what's going on. Yeah. And they do the same sorts of things in this one. I mean, there's some interesting ideas in it, but it's surrounded by what's really just a dumb, fun, you know, action movie. And there's some cool action bits in it. I felt like the gratuitous stuff was gratuitous.
Yeah. See episode 40-something.
Yeah. Not that long ago. And then the third one, what was the other? Oh, Patriot Games.
Oh, yeah.
Which is the only Jack Ryan movie I hadn't seen yet.
Have you seen that? Yeah, because my first one was Clear and Present Danger, which we watched like constantly.
Yeah.
We loved that one.
Yeah, that's the other Harrison Ford one, which I think that one's better. This one actually came first, but I don't think it's aged as well as Clear and Present Danger has. I mean, it's not a bad movie. I mean, this one it's also rated R, but this one felt like it could have been PG-13.
Okay, yeah.
I don't even remember why it's R. There must have been an F-bomb thrown somewhere. Yeah. I mean, and it's not bad. It's just like, it's nothing, you know, if you've seen the other Jack Ryan movies, this one doesn't really have much new to offer.
Yeah, I think Clear and Present Danger is actually the only Jack Ryan movie I've seen all the way through.
Oh, really?
I mean, I haven't seen the new one. Have you seen the new one?
Yes.
See, I haven't seen that
one. Well, there's been two.
There's two?
Yeah, there was one a few years ago with Ben Affleck, I think.
Oh, I might have seen that one, actually, now that you mentioned that.
Yeah.
I was thinking the Star Trek guy.
Yeah, Chris Pine.
I haven't seen that one.
That one was fun. That one was a lot of fun. Which it's funny. I don't think that one is even based off a actual Tom Clancy book.
Just, they just made a
movie. but they still had all the trappings.
See, Clear Present Danger. It came out at some time where like we watched it a lot, and then like we took a train trip and it played, and we took a plane trip and it was on everywhere, and we loved it. And we still do this day in our family. We'll say stuff like "I don't dance the two step," or we'll still say something. He's the Latin Jack Ryan.
Yeah.
You know, it's just absurd.
The first time I saw a scene of that, we watched a scene of that in one of my editing classes in film school, because it has that one scene where he's on the computer and then the guy he's investigating comes in to use like the office that's across from him. And it's a great example of showing simultaneous action.
Okay.
Because they're both in their own offices like trying to get this thing, you know, and it's going on at the same time. And it's really paced really well. But then I got me, it's like, oh, I gotta go watch the movie now.
Nice.
But I would say that one's better than Patriot Games. Okay. I mean, again, not bad.
Yeah.
But of the three,
with the Irish?
Yes.
Okay, I have seen parts of it then at least.
And Sean Bean's a bad guy.
Okay.
That's one of the ones where he's a bad guy.
He dies?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Yeah.
Which Sean V doesn't actually get killed in every movie, but it's often enough that it's funny. But so yeah, cool. there's nice. Three movies, and of the three, if you're looking for the most interesting experience, I'd have to go with Big Trouble in Little China.
That would sound like fun. Yeah, let me just redeem the Faulkner real quick. With before that, I had read A Wizard of Earthsea. And just if you want to, I will do my super short, super good, like classic fantasy sort of stuff. Like the language is great and it's not very long. And it's really neat.
Would you want to read any more Earthsea books?
I think it would. It was written in such a style that I'm not sure if we want to follow it right up. It's not a book. It's not like a fantasy that's plot driven in the sense that like you have to turn pages.
Okay.
But it's a very beautiful book and it does a really nice thing with language and building this world and this character and the magic system very much about the true names of things.
Okay.
And it's really fascinating. Everyone always kind of ranked that as one of those fantasy books up there with Tolkien and stuff. And it certainly is written very, very well. I mean, it's certainly literary fantasy.
Cool.
And it was certainly worth reading. I'd be interested in reading more Ursula Le Guin. I think that was the first book I read of hers. I'm like, yeah, I'd read more of this.
Yeah, since you liked it, this definitely sounds like something I'd like to check out sometime.
It's certainly much slower paced than like modern fantasy tends to be.
Slower than Brandon Sanderson then?
Yeah, Sanderson tries to make things move. He's very good at pacing. Mm-hmm. And this is much more leisure. It's a little more mythic, you know, a little more, not quite Silmarillion, not that old and mythic. But, you know, more like a Hobbit. Lord of the Rings style. Okay. You know, we're just sort of
a little more old fashioned.
Old, yeah, it is very old fashioned.
As opposed to like
a movie version of, you know.
Yeah, modern sort of sensibility.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we better wrap this up.
Yeah, that's a long one, but I want to throw that into counterbalance my Faulkner. So. All right, I guess first we'll do contact info.
Like we said earlier, leave us a comment at deareoldtrainsofthought.blogspot.com. Let us know if there's a movie on Netflix that you think we should check out.
Maybe we should sometime like take someone's request and like do a hijack on that.
Oh, that could be kind of fun. Yeah, find out something that you want us to talk about and we'll do it. And maybe we'll get a Patreon and we'll like have people pay us to do stuff. And
there you go. Ha ha. We'll make millions of cents.
a few dollars.
A few dollars at least. Oh, you can visit us on our YouTube channel. See all our different stuff.
Don't forget to check out the Weekly Hijack. It's still on. We just finished season one of Lost.
Yes. It might be a little pause before two because I know I'll be gone for two.
Depends on when this episode comes out. Yeah. But.
And email us at deareoldtrains@gmail.com.
That's right.
We check it occasionally.
You never know.
All right. So I hear like bulldozers or something coming.
Oh.
And the tone of this whole force is just changing drastically.
Yeah, they seem to be a lot of gloom and doom around.
Yeah, so. Well, they did say this is the last rainforest, so.
Oh, there's never going to be another rainforest after this one, apparently. Yeah. Oh,
okay, well, why don't we go out with some music, some good music, at least?
All right, like Nick, I don't have a real great knowledge of current games. I'm sure there are some that probably get to have a real preachy message in there. But since I'm not familiar with those, instead I went with Kingdom Hearts, which
we never heard that before. So
it's been a little while. Kingdom Hearts
is great music.
I don't do it as often as Final Fantasy VI, and sometimes you know it does get a little on the nose. It has a lot of my friends are my power.
Yeah, it is very that. Yes.
That type of stuff. But it also has like for a game that has Disney characters in it, there's a surprising amount of undertones about existence and non-existence, and the DS game Recoded is this really insane mix of like Inception Matrix stuff.
And then Friends and
yes,
but then turn that frown upside down, this ship runs on happy faces.
Yes, basically. So anywho, but this song is called Trinity and it is remixed by Superio, I guess is how you say the name. He's a newcomer at the time. This is actually just came out a few months ago. And I think
it's good stuff.
A nice trance remix of the song Dearly Beloved.
All right. Well, let's
enjoy it.
Move on out of here then.
All right. Thanks for listening.
Well, this is Nick.
And this is Tim.
Adios.
Bye.
Bye.